Christians and Muslims on the First Coast are expressing their horror at the persecution of people of faith. Just ahead, a discussion about the brutality behind the self-proclaimed Islamic State, also called ISIS or ISIL. Good morning. Live from Studio 5, this is First Coast Connect on 89.9. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Jessica Palumbo, sitting in for Melissa Ross, who's on vacation. First Coast Connect, always live on the radio. And now catch our daily podcast on iTunes. Just ahead, we'll take your calls as local faith leaders speak out against ISIS. The number is 549-2937. Then later, a local author wins the Faulkner Prize, plus sports with Cole Pepper. All of that ahead. But first this morning, faith leaders on the First Coast are speaking out about the brutality and extremism of the organization that calls itself the Islamic State. ISIS controls an area of Iraq and Syria the size of the United Kingdom. Iraqi government forces and allied militias have had some success pushing ISIS back out of the city of Tikrit, but the group continues gaining territory elsewhere, including in Nigeria with the allegiance of the group Boko Haram. Here in the U.S., outrage and alarm over the group's butchery and persecution of those they term infidels continues to grow. This morning, we welcome two leaders from the First Coast faith community to discuss the so-called Islamic State. Here with more, we welcome Dr. Parvez Ahmed of the Islamic Center of Northeast Florida.
Thank you.
And Father Nick Lowe, pastor at St. John the Divine Greek Orthodox Church. Welcome.
Great to be with you, Jessica.
To our callers, let us know your thoughts about ISIS. What do you know about the group? What's the best way to fight it? And how much of a threat do you feel they pose here on the First Coast? That number, again, is 549-2937, or go to wjctnews.org/firstcoastconnect to email us, or tweet me at Jessica Pub Radio. That's Jessica, P-U-B, Radio. Parvez, you argue that to defeat ISIS, we need a better understanding of history. What do you mean by that?
Well, ISIS did not start in vacuum. Had we not invaded Iraq kind of completely botched up the post-Iraq, post-war reconstruction of Iraq, we wouldn't have seen what we are seeing today. So it has, its roots are in, since 9/11, we launched the war on terror. We went to Afghanistan. We did not completely take out Al-Qaeda in Afghanistan. And then we launched the Iraq war. And today we are reaping the fruits of that illegal invasion of Iraq.
Nick, it's been reported that Muslims who don't support ISIS are targets for its violence in the Middle East. But you tell us about, you have concerns about the persecution of Christians over there as well. And you said your congregation here in Jacksonville actually has ties to what's happening over there. Can you explain?
Absolutely. I mean, the Orthodox Church in Jacksonville has a very strong presence. And so my church, along with several other communities here in Jacksonville, have direct relations and are directly impacted by what's going on in the Middle East. You have to keep in mind that the Orthodox Church represents one of the largest Christian bodies in the Middle East. And so in Syria and in Iraq, Libya, Egypt, areas in which you're seeing this organization, this so-called ISIS organization growing, they're growing in areas in which there is a very large Christian community. Keep in mind there are like 20 million Christians living in the Middle East. And so the concern is that obviously on the one end, there are enormous persecution of people of all faith traditions, Muslims included, that are being killed because they don't ascribe to that certain philosophy of ISIS. On the other hand, Christians, I would say especially, who really don't have an area of defense are struggling tremendously. We've got Orthodox priests, bishops, their bodies have been mutilated, killed. Our women are being raped. So our children are used as slaves. So the concern is that this organization is growing. And I think I would agree with what Dr. Parvez had mentioned. I think there's this lack of true leadership in that area has caused an organization like ISIS to grow under people like Saddam Hussein, Gaddafi, Mubarak. By no means do I want to imply that these people were much more tolerant, but the Christians lived in those regions under a lot better circumstances than what they're living in right now.
Is this something that you talk about with your colleagues?
I mean, absolutely, because it impacts us. Because, you know, Christianity, like, you know, Islam and Judaism, these are global religions. They are, and so what's happening in Israel or happening in Egypt or Syria or Iraq or directly impacts us. And as a Christian faith, we are called to be aware of our brothers and sisters, not just in our inner circle that we have within our friends and family locally, but how it impacts our faith throughout the world. So absolutely, it's impacting us.
And as we're seeing these videos coming out of the Middle East and the barbarism that is happening locally, what is the response? Is there anything that you can do for the people over there?
Well, I think, you know, Dr. Parvez and I are very close friends. I consider ourselves brothers. We're part of an interfaith organization known as One Jax. But within that organization, Rabbi Joshua Leaf, Kyle Reese are very close friends of ours that are trying to work towards trying to develop programs that not only educate the people of Jacksonville about not only what our faith traditions believe and what we represent, but also how there can be diversity, but in that diversity, there could be unity. We can have different faith traditions. We can think differently theologically, but we still look at each other with the same loving eyes that God tells us that we should look at each other with.
Yeah, I think if you look at ISIS first, we have to be very realistic in kind of defining who this group is. ISIS is as much Islamic as KKK is Christian. So they do draw upon verses from the sacred text to justify their violence, just like KKK does to draw upon to justify their violence using sacred texts. So I think and the second thing we need to realize about ISIS is that ISIS does not represent an existential threat to the U.S. It represents an existential threat to the people in the region, mm-hmm. Whether they're Christians or Muslims, as Father Nick just said. Most of the victims of ISIS violence are Muslims living in the region. Mm-hmm. Of course, Christians and other minorities like the Yazidis are also targets of their violence. So given that situation in the Middle East, I think we have to be realistic in the way we approach this thing, which means that we have to build a multinational, multi-religious, multi-ethnic front to fight this scourge.
Related to what you both just said, we have a tweet I want to read to you from a listener. It says, can your guests talk about the shared origin of Islam, Christianity, and Judaism in Abraham and why it should bring us together? Who wants to start?
Well, I can start. I mean, indeed, Abraham is regarded as the father of monotheism, and from his personality and his preaching and his ministry, so to speak, we get the faith traditions of Christianity, Judaism, and Islam. Abraham is literally defined, is regarded as the great-great-great-grandfather of Prophet Muhammad, as he is of other biblical prophets like Jesus and Moses and others. So, one of the most important traditions of Islam, which is the Hajj, which is one of the pillars of Islam, actually follows in the footsteps of Abraham and his wife Hagar.
Mm-hmm.
Father Nick?
Absolutely. I mean, that's the irony in this whole thing, is that here you have three of the Abrahamic faith traditions tracing their lineage back to Abraham, and sharing the philosophy that God, when God promises to Abraham that to all that I will promise to you and to all of your descendants this area, this land, what that truly means is that there was a coexistence that I think God desired for the people to live at that time and to continue to live. And as far as Christians are concerned, our lineage does trace back to Abraham. Where we would differ is theologically, is that in the personage of who Christ is for us in the Christian tradition, Christ is our God. And so we would say that we worship that Jesus Christ was the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. So,
if you're just joining us, we are discussing ISIS this morning with local faith leaders, Dr. Parvez Ahmed of the Islamic Center of Northeast Florida and Father Nick Lowe, pastor at St. John the Divine Greek Orthodox Church. The number to call is 549-2937 or tweet us at Jessica Pub Radio. That's Jessica PUB Radio. Now, there's been a lot of talk recently about what to call this group, right? Mm-hmm. For example, NPR editors say that we need to make sure we're saying self-proclaimed Islamic State or the so-called Islamic State because it's not an official territory recognized by the rest of the world. And then there's this idea of whether they can be called Islamic at all. And in a recent cover story in The Atlantic called What ISIS really wants, the writer Graham Wood argues the Islamic State is, in fact, an Islamic organization. At the same time, that's something President Obama has discounted. Parvez, what do you think is the best way to define this organization, and is that even important?
It is important how what we define, but it is not crucial. What do I mean by that? If you look at the Graham Wood article in The Atlantic, he says that Islamic State is Islamic. And yet in the same article, he goes on to say that the overwhelming majority of Muslims, I would argue probably 99% of the Muslims, reject ISIS. So how can something be Islamic and yet rejected by such large numbers of Muslims around the world? If ISIS was indeed an Islamic, quote-unquote Islamic group, then we would have found, particularly now that they proclaim that they govern a state and they rule a territory, we would have seen many, many numbers, large numbers of Muslims join their cause. Now, there are some Muslims around the world, particularly the vulnerable and disenfranchised youth from Europe and also a little bit from America also, and from other parts of the world that are responding to the calls of ISIS and trying to go and join them. But the numbers remain very, very small. So we have to be very realistic in the way we assess the threat, in way we characterize the threat, which would include the naming of this group. So I think it is fair to label them as so-called Islamic State because the vast majority of Muslims reject their mantle of Islam, their version of Islam that they use to justify their violence. And also they are a pseudo-state. They're not really a state that is recognized by anybody.
When you hear this label, an Islamic organization, to label ISIS, does that make you think about the people who live here in the United States and how that might make people who are non-Muslim view them in a more negative light?
It does. And so we do see at the same time where we see this rise of the rise of the ISIS phenomenon, we also find concurrent trends of increasing anti-Muslim sentiments. Islamophobia in Europe is on the rise. The right wing, the far right party in France, which has been campaigning on a anti-Arab, anti-Muslim platform, is gaining popularity in France and may win the next presidency of France. In the U.S. also, we have heard calls from not only political leaders, but some faith leaders, but also very irresponsible television and radio hosts who have characterized regions in Europe as so-called no-go zones, which the recently the mayor of Paris said that's just ridiculous and irresponsible kind of journalism. So we see this, the phenomenon of ISIS has also led to the phenomenon of rising Islamophobia, both in the U.S. and around the world.
Your questions at 549-2937. Right now we have Hector on the line. Hector, you're on air.
Yes, thank you. Thank you for taking my call. First of all, I'd like to say that ISIS or ISIL or whatever they call it has nothing to do with Islam. The second thing I'd like to say is when they killed Saddam Hussein, that literally opened up the gates of hell for all of these terrorist organizations to come out and start killing the Sunni population. And the other thing, Muammar Gaddafi, the same thing. You kill that person, you open up the gates of hell in that direction. And you know, the only thing that can be done now is to for the world to get together as it's doing and try and destroy these people because they have nothing to do with religion. They have nothing to do with Islam. They're a bunch of terrorists and a bunch of thugs, like some of the media has said. And I would hope that everybody understands that these people, they are not Islamic. They are not believers of God. Believers of God do not kill their fellow man in any religion. Thank you.
Hector, thank you for your call. Dr. Parvez, our caller says they are not Islamic, have nothing to do with religion.
Well, first of all, as I said, the primary victims of ISIS's terror are Muslims in the region. The vast majority of victims of Al-Qaeda's terror are Muslims in the region. So again, it is kind of oxymoronic to say that you are acting in the name of Islam but killing your fellow co-religionists. So that itself is the irony and the paradox of the situation.
We have Chuck on the line at the beaches. Chuck, you're on the air.
Hi, I wanted to address something one of your guests said. I think he said, if I understood him to say, he said that ISIS is not a threat to us here in the United States. And I would ask him about the shoe bomber, the underwear bomber, the Twin Towers, the Boston issue, the psychiatrist that shot 13 people in America. I think it would be somewhat naive for us to not recognize that religious fundamentalists, which is, if you want to use that term, is a threat to us here in the United States, and we have to, and in France and England and everywhere, we have to be on guard against fundamentalist religious terrorists.
So let me clarify what I said. I did not say they're not a threat. They are a threat. They're not an existential threat, meaning they do not pose such a level of threat that would derail our democracy and our democratic ideals. And what I mean by that is, and I've been speaking out against this since 9/11, that as we calibrate our response to this terror, we have to be mindful that we do not undermine the freedoms and the values of us as Americans, which we have already done through our NSA phone tapping and spying and to our torture programs and all of these other things that we have done since 9/11. We have actually undermined our values to fight them. Because we have initially after 9/11, in declaring the war on terror, we deemed Al-Qaeda an existential threat to us. And so we thought that to defeat this threat, it is okay for us to undermine our values and our ideals. In my view, it is not. We can still fight them, and we do need to fight them, and we do need to defeat them. They do represent a threat, as just exactly like the caller had said, they have attacked our homeland in many situations and probably are plotting to do it again. So our law enforcement have to be vigilant, our citizens have to be vigilant, but we also have to be mindful that we do not undermine our values and our ideals in fighting this threat.
Julie, can I add something to that?
Yes.
You know, I think it's important to realize, at least in my perspective, is I think what one of the short-term goals that I think ISIS desires is to create a holy war and to create and to rise the temperature between the Christian community, really of faith traditions, and to have some sort of a war that exists. And I think what needs to happen on a local and I would argue national and really international level is that, yes, we have to pray for peace in the Quran and in the Torah, as well as in the Christian New Testament. There's an extreme emphasis on the word peace. We greet each other in the Islamic tradition with assalamu alaikum, you know, the Jewish tradition, it's shalom. And in the English tradition, Jesus approached the disciples after his resurrection saying, peace be with you. So we've got to do everything in our power as faith leaders in speaking up in a very direct and informative way about promoting and perpetuating peace, because it's what our leader, what our tradition teaches us, but also demanding and encouraging our civil leaders to be looking at developing peace all throughout the world, not always just in our own self-interest, but looking at how we can create peace. Because I think what would be the worst thing that we could do is to create tension between religions. That, yes, there were times throughout history where Islam and Christianity and Judaism may have not always gotten along. Just like in our own country, we've had struggles on political issues. But it doesn't mean that I can't look at each other, like at my brother Parvez, and he look at me, and we're still that we're the same. That God created us in His image and likeness, and we should be treating people that way. So I encourage the faith leaders also to speak up about this and to try to perpetuate more peace as opposed to division.
Going to the phones, we have Greg in Mandarin. Greg, you're on the air.
Yes, thank you for taking my call, and thank you for having these men here for this great cause. I have a question about how does this fit into history? We've known that Muslims have fought Muslims, Christians have fought Christians, and Muslims have fought Christians. Historically, where do you think this falls? Because this kind of has some undefined lines. Because you have Egypt now, Jordan, and even crossing those lines, the Japanese have been affected. So how do you think this will fall into history?
Thank you for your question, Greg.
I do not have a crystal ball to give you a good sense of how this will be looked back 20 years from now, or where we will be even 5 years from now. But when we look at the situation today, we have to understand that the rise of these kind of violent groups is primarily because of the lack of freedom, lack of opportunity, lack of political space, lack of economic viability of those societies. So if you look at the vast, across the region of Middle East, you see mostly large numbers of youth. Youth unemployment is astronomically high. People do not have freedom because they're still ruled by brutal dictators, whether they are in Syria or in Egypt even, or even in countries that are our allies, such as Saudi Arabia and Qatar and among others. So when we look at that region politically is still an unresolved problem and a dilemma. And it has been like that for many, many decades. Going back historically, many experts have argued that the way the modern Middle East has been carved out after the colonialist powers had left the Middle East through the Sykes-Picot Act, and the way the borders of modern Middle Eastern countries had been drawn, this was almost inevitable. Mm-hmm. This was foreseen. So how do we address it? It goes back to addressing the root causes of these problems, giving people in the region hope, giving people in the region an economic path to success. And I think we will begin to address some of these problems.
Going to the phones now, we have Tom calling from the north side. Tom, you're on the air.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call. I have been involved with the Middle East ever since the 70s. And, I've seen things happen in that region, and you could go on and on about what's happening and why. And everybody has an opinion. But it seems to me that if the Muslim community wants to prove or wants to show the world that they are not bad or all bad or however you want to put it, then they should have a certain responsibility to separate themselves from these extremist groups. In the same way that back when certain people were killing abortion doctors in the name of a particular religion, those religions were right on it. They're like, this is not us. And that's the thing that a lot of people don't understand, the Muslims. And I welcome them, a peaceful anybody. But the point is that a lot of Muslims, that they want to feel like a victim, but they're not doing anything to separate themselves from the people that, in a way for people to understand, because if people don't know any different.
Tom, thanks for your comments, Dr. Prevez.
Yeah, what I would suggest to everybody who is, I think the caller makes some very important points. I think the most important point he made is that people do not understand Muslims. If you look at polling data since 9/11, negative sentiments about Islam and Muslims and misunderstanding about Islam and Muslims is on the rise. And on this, and one of the factors that is causing this rise is these violent images and the violence that is happening in the Middle East. So one of the ways for people to get a grasp of this situation is this: to just simply go to Google and type in "Muslims condemn terrorism" and see what comes up. And you will probably find pages and pages and websites after websites documenting Muslim leaders before 9/11, after 9/11, since 9/11, even today, with eloquent condemnations of ISIS and such terror. So the question is, will condemnation alone solve this problem? And my contention has always been that condemnations are important. The Muslim community and Muslims leaders need to speak out. They have spoken out, but they need to continue to speak out, and they need to be more articulate, and they need to be more forceful, and they need to talk to their own congregations and not only have this being preached from the pulpit, but also have kitchen table conversations about it. But condemnations alone is not going to solve this problem. It is rooted in deep politics that dates back almost to the pre-colonial time. And it is rooted in the politics that has shaped the modern Middle East, including the U.S. entanglement in the region, continuing from the days of the deposing of the elected president of Iran, continuing all the way up to today. All of those are factors, and there are no easy answers. It is easy to say, well, if only the Muslim community condemned these actions, this problem would go away. I wish it were true.
Father Nick?
Yeah, I mean, I totally agree. I think that there definitely needs to be more of a voice from all faith traditions, the Islamic tradition as well as the Christian tradition and the Jewish tradition. I mean, as far as from a Christian perspective, there is a mass exodus of Christians that have been leaving the Middle East over the last 30 to 40 years. And that needs to be discussed. Why are these happening? What is happening in that region? And it's not as, I think as Dr. Parvez beautifully stated, it's not, we try to sometimes pigeonhole and answer, this is the reason why things are happening. I mean, there are, I would argue to our Christian leaders that, you know, there are large amounts of financial support going to helping to build Israeli settlements in Israel that's putting an enormous amount of pressure on the Christians living in Israel. So many of them. I mean, so you have to think of things on a how what it's like a domino effect. When we look at the Middle East in general, why are we having not only this continued violence among religions that all perpetuate this level of so-called peace, but why? But also the reason why people are leaving and the enormous pressure that they are under. My wife's cousin died about 2 weeks ago, living in Syria, 45 years old. Because of the pressure, had a massive heart attack because of the pressure living there. So we hear of the blood and the wars, but the psychological consequences of children, young Muslim children, young Jewish children, young Christian children living in that area, what they're growing up with and what they're experiencing. We're so blessed that we live in a nation that allows us the freedom to do what we're doing now, but these young children do not, and they grow up and with that very much a war mindset, and it's scary. It's scary for where we are right now. And to go back to the earlier call about what's going to happen, how this will look in history, I think it's still being written. And it concerns me that if faith leaders do not speak up now, where we could be in the future on this issue.
The number to join the conversation, 549-2937. We have a caller on the line, Matt, calling from Avondale. Matt, you're on the air.
Hi, good morning, and thank you for taking my call. I have to say this is a very good panel. I really enjoy what they have to bring to the table. But I often find in these discussions there's something missing. And in this case, this is always couched in terms of faith. And my question, I guess, for all of the panelists is, where is the place at the table for people of no faith, people who do not argue over who owns the mind of God and whose sacred text is more accurate or less accurate? I think there's a lot to learn from that community. I think this cannot be couched solely in terms of faith, because there's no end to arguments over faith, because there's no right answer to arguments over faith. I think a real dose of secularism, the kind that has served our nation so well, at least until very recently, would do an awful lot of good. And my question, is there a place at the table for these? Can we find people from these war-torn communities of no faith that can have something to bring to the table?
Matt, thank you for your question.
Well, I will quote a Hindu sage who I had the privilege of meeting several years ago. He had said something that stuck with me for many, many years. He said that today in the world, we need to spiritualize politics and secularize faith. Mm-hmm. What did he mean by that? And our politics and our politicians need a dose of humility, need to understand the true service to which they're called to have that as part of their policy. Not to look at people as categories, that Muslims, Christians, blacks, whites, but look to people as people. On the other side, as the caller rightly mentioned, we also need a dose of secularizing faith, because too often faith leaders and faith, the adherents of faith, they only look at their people as victims, and they forget the others that are also being victimized, partly because of their co-religionist or for others. And to the caller's point, that what about the people of no faith? As I mentioned, the biggest challenge in solving the problem of Middle East is the politics and the economy of the region. And to that end, everybody's support would be needed, whether you are a person of faith or no faith, because ISIS and groups like ISIS represent a threat to humanity. And because of that, it requires a coalition building of people across faith traditions and across non-faith traditions to fight this thing. And because it is a human challenge, it has been brought about by the policies that many people have done, and many people have prescribed, some advertent and some inadvertent, some unintended consequences. For example, when the CIA deposed the elected leader of Mossadegh, that in some sense led to, many decades later, led to the Islamic Revolution that brought the current Iranian regime to power. The one would argue that was an unintended consequence of that coup. But nonetheless, we have to, again, as I said, as I quote this Hindu leader that taught me this, that we need to spiritualize our politics. We need to approach these issues with a dose of humility.
Can I respond?
Yes.
Yeah, I think I totally agree with Parvez on that comment. I one of my biggest inspirations is Gandhi, and I love how he says that we are to be the change, that we are the change that is needed in this world. And, you know, at our core, irrespective of religion, we all desire to have dignity, human rights, to be loved, to be accepted, to be appreciated. These are things that every person deserves to have. And it's written, obviously, in our Constitution, something that we try our best as a nation to do. And I think if that becomes the platform, irrespective of religion, if we allow ourselves to look at that, these are the core principles that every single human, whether they are in Africa, the Middle East, Asia, Europe, or in this country or South America, if every single person has the opportunity to experience that, every child has the opportunity to experience that, imagine what the world could be. I think that's how we could invite and how we should invite everyone to the table on those core principles.
So you both may have seen the WJCT debate between the three major candidates for the mayor of Jacksonville. And in addition to the questions about local issues like downtown development and pensions, the candidates were asked a question about ISIS, actually. The question was, last month, the FBI arrested an accused ISIL supporter right here in Jacksonville. Were you surprised by that? That's what the candidates had to respond to. What are your thoughts about that question? And were you surprised at the arrest of that man?
Well, I was. At the arrest of the man, I do not know who this person is. In all my years of associating with the Muslim community in Jacksonville, I've never met this person or know about what his affiliations or associations are. In some sense, it is unfair to target the Muslim community because of this person. But at the same time, our political leaders have a role to play, in my view. And as Father Nick has said, the role that political leaders can play is to unify the community, to not let minorities, religious minorities or racial minorities living in this community to feel targeted, to feel victimized because of bad apples within their communities. To that end, I would hope that whoever the next mayor is will continue to reach out across faith communities and work with these faith communities to create a better Jacksonville for everybody.
Father Nick, were you surprised by this arrest?
You know, with this advent of the internet and its impact and how people have easy access to all of this stuff that is both positive and negative information that you can receive on the internet, I'm becoming less and less surprised. And what concerns me is, you know, bad news always travels quicker than good news. And when you have a situation where a young man is being influenced by whatever he's reading or his philosophy or his viewpoint of what Islam is, I think that we run the risk of that. And that goes back to our point of faith leaders in all traditions need to continue to speak up in a very forceful way about divisiveness and dividing our people and trying to find ways to unify ourselves, even though we may have theological differences, as well as our politicians. Because I think that this is, you know, I don't think Europe 10 years ago thought that they would be experiencing what they're experiencing now. And I think trouble happens when, as the famous quote goes, when good people stay quiet. And so people need to speak up and talk about unity and cohesiveness, and even though there might be diversity, we can be unified in our approach to peace in the world.
Thank you so much. We've been talking with Father Nick Lowe, pastor at St. John the Divine Greek Orthodox Church, and Dr. Parvez Ahmed of the Islamic Center of Northeast Florida. Much more still ahead. Later in the hour, Culpepper has a look at sports. But up next, a local author wins the Faulkner Literary Prize for an emerging novel for his tale looking at LGBT prejudice. That's after this.
WJCT's Travel and Entertainment Auction is where you'll find over 300 items, most starting at 75% off at auction.wjct.org. Packages include lodging, attractions, dining, recreation, beauty, and more. Log on to auction.wjct.org for more information.
Last chance to grab a deal. Bidding ends tonight at 9.
The Florida Legislature is in session, and Capitol Report is your nightly connection to what's happening in Tallahassee as lawmakers debate and decide issues that affect all Floridians, such as expanding health care and gambling, protecting the state's water resources, private versus public schools, and prison reform. Hear Capitol Report each weeknight during the legislative session on this Florida Public Radio station.
Weeknights at 6:30 on WJCT 89.9.
WJCTnews.org is your source for the latest local, national, and international news 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. Podcasts of your favorite local stories and shows, the WJCT First Read every weekday morning, and playlists from all of our after-hours music programming. From your computer or mobile device, see it all at WJCTnews.org.
Welcome back. Jacksonville's controversial human rights ordinance is a big topic in local politics and the city's mayor's race. At the same time, a local author has written a timely book looking at the culture of prejudice toward the LGBT community. Finding Pluck is the book. It's a coming-of-age novel, and it's the first prize winner of the International William Faulkner Literary Awards for Emerging Writers. The Faulkner Literary Awards has been paying tribute to works of literature for decades and attracts entries from all over the world. Jacksonville Beach author Peter DeFatta joins us now in studio with more about this story. And if you have questions for Peter, call us at 549-2937 or tweet me at Jessica Pub Radio. That's Jessica P-U-B Radio. Good morning, Peter.
Good morning, Jessica. Thank you for having me on the show.
Thanks for being here. Can you tell us what inspired your story? You said you were working on it for 5 years.
Well, first of all, I belong to a writer's group, and we bring in some writing every week. And so I got started with this idea about having a student who is in a bad situation at home. His mother's sick. They have financial problems. He comes from a dying small textile town in North Carolina. And he needs financial aid in order to go to college. He's accepted to a state university, but he can't afford to go. And so he goes to the counselor at the university. And he's seeing all these scholarships, and none of them apply to him. A lot of them require teaching after a year or so. I mean, for 2 years or so, and then the counselor mentions this gay equality scholarship that pays for everything and even supplies a stipend, and he says, and he starts thinking about it. But anyway,
is the character gay himself?
No, he's not.
Okay.
And the thing of it is, he decides to apply for the scholarship, and he receives it, and. Immediately, when it's announced at his graduation ceremony, he faces all sorts of intolerance from the rest of the students, even some intolerance from the teacher, some of the teachers, and the principal, too. And worse yet, he awakens the ghost of the long-dead benefactor of the scholarship. So now he has to contend with not only intolerance and prejudice against him, but he also has to contend with a ghost that is haunting him. So anyway, the story came about that way, and it just sort of developed. And the more I got into it, I did more examinations of the culture of prejudice. And one of the things that the character's name is Taylor, that he's required to do is he has to attend LGBT meetings at the university on at least once a month and do reports on it. Or he can also do papers and things like that. And so in the process, he has to do a lot of research. And he begins learning about the culture of prejudice. And he learns that, you know, it comes through in many ways, and it the laws, the religion, and traditions of our society, and also bias and ignorance, all form barriers that have harmed minorities in the past. And a lot of these laws, as well as our traditions, have been formed oftentimes on the basis of religion, mm-hmm. And particularly certain interpretations of the Bible. And we have to think back about prejudice in our history. The Bible has been used to justify slavery, and then later Jim Crow laws, and also keeping women in a secondary position. And even today, it's still being used to justify denying gays of certain rights and to keep and to keep certain discriminatory laws on the books. So I thought it was a good way to kind of address this issue. But the book is not just all heavy social issues either. It's really kind of a fun read where you have an interesting character and who runs into other interesting characters.
Some of whom are dead.
And the way I dealt with that is that I put flashbacks.
Okay.
So the novel takes place in 1995. That's when this student is going to school. But it also flashes back to 1927, which was an age of great turmoil and great change in our country. Women were getting some freedoms for the first time in their life. In 1920, they got the right to vote. So, and of course, there was resistance to all of these things, just like, you know, we see a lot of resistance today to a lot of changes, like gay marriage and things like that. So back then, there was people resisting equality for blacks, as well as, you know, even women voting. You know, a lot of people just didn't want that to happen because that's not the way it was done. And then, you know, and our beliefs don't coincide with that.
So when you were writing this, why did you choose to have the main character not actually be gay?
Well, the reason was it's always interesting to put a character in a situation where he's not the most, not natural and most, you know, comfortable. It would be, there was once a book where a man, for instance, he colored his skin dark, and he lived the life of a black man, and it became a pretty famous novel. So just putting somebody in a situation that that they're not comfortable with, or, you know, the old thing of walking in somebody else's shoes, mm-hmm. always generates a good story, because then you get to see how other people lived and felt.
Are you hoping the reader will sort of imagine themselves walking in someone else's shoes in the same way?
I most certainly do. I think, first of all, hopefully you will identify with the protagonist, which is Taylor, and see that his internal struggles and find out some of the embarrassments that he's been facing, and identify with it, and then also, you go along and listen to what he's learning, what his research teaches him. He grows a lot in the novel. All the characters grow a lot, and I think that's part of the coming-of-age novel. And it's also tied into the title, which is Finding Pluck.
Right.
Pluck is defined as a spirited and determined courage. And what I was trying to say is that in the course of the novel, Taylor in particular finds his spirited and determined courage, and he comes out on the other side a stronger person than at the beginning of the novel. And the other people throughout the novel grew too.
Thank you so much. We've been talking with author Peter DeFatta, Jacksonville Beach author of the novel Finding Pluck. Back in a moment with Culpepper and Sports.
Mm-hmm. Congratulations to writer James English, winner of the first quarter of The Square. Now it's your chance to show off your art, whether it's music, visual art, sculpture, poetry, and more. Go to wjct.org/The Square, check out the amazing local talent, and submit your work now.
When a mama and daddy moved into the house across the street.
Dr. Annette Snapp is operations manager of the Ottauquechee Seminole Indian Museum and an archaeologist. I'm Ben Brotmarkle, and coming up on Florida Frontiers, the weekly radio magazine of the Florida Historical Society, we'll talk with Dr. Snapp about her search for Fort Shackelford, built in 1855. We'll discuss salvaging shipwrecks in the Florida Keys and talk about Puerto Rican immigration. That's Florida Frontiers, Monday evening at 6:30 on 89.9 WJCT.
Welcome back. And finally this hour.
I'm a pepper, he's a pepper, she's a pepper, we're a pepper. Wouldn't you like to be a pepper too?
Ol' Pepper's here now with a look at sports.
And we are in the depths of March Madness right now. It is upon us, and it is for UNF. Yesterday, Jessica, on the UNF campus, the team, the students, supporters, a lot of media as well, gathered to watch the Selection Sunday announcement, and about 6:22 p.m., the word came down. We knew that UNF was already going to be in because they had won the Atlantic Sun Conference Tournament, but the word came down they would play in one of the first four games, called because they were the first four games played, and played outside of the rest of the bracket. They'll go to Dayton and play on Wednesday. In fact, they're leaving this morning to head to Dayton. They'll play Robert Morris on Wednesday. Now, why is this significant? Well, it's significant because UNF has never been to the NCAA tournament before, but also because they have a chance to actually win a game here, and it would not be a huge upset by any stretch of the imagination. The field that was once 64 is now 68, which means those four games include two games involving a pair of 16 seeds, the last seeds in each regional. And so UNF is that, as is Robert Morris. So it's actually a chance not just to play in the NCAA tournament, but actually win a game in the NCAA tournament. I'm not saying that they couldn't win any more games, but if they would win on Wednesday, they'd have to travel to Charlotte on Friday and play Duke.
Uh-oh.
So So probably not a popular pick to go through beyond the matchup against Duke. But what a season it's been for UNF. Now, on the other hand, as UNF is getting ready to do their thing, March Madness is coming to Jacksonville, and we'll have games Thursday and Saturday at the Jacksonville Veterans Memorial Arena. And among the teams coming here, this should be quite a big turnout. North Carolina is among the teams coming to Jacksonville. North Carolina plays against the Ivy League champions Harvard in the first round. So we'll also see teams like Xavier playing either BYU or Ole Miss, who play in one of those first four games as well. Baylor takes on Georgia State. And we also have Arkansas against Wofford. Everybody's looking at their brackets right now. One of the things I think is a real benefit for UNF, beyond just basketball, is everybody from the hardcore sports fan to Janice in accounts receivable is probably going to look at and think about filling out a tournament bracket,
sure.
Right? The office pool,
right.
For entertainment purposes only. And here we have UNF on a piece of paper for every single person around the country that is looking at doing an office pool. And this is one of the big benefits of having a team play in the NCAA tournament. A couple of years ago, a team out of the same conference as UNF and JU play in, Florida Gulf Coast, mm-hmm. won two games in the NCAA tournament, and their admissions and enrollment numbers skyrocketed after that. So this is about as good a PR opportunity as a school can get to spread the word that, hey, we exist and we're here.
Yeah.
And already UNF has had stories on ESPN and Fox Sports and so forth, and showcasing the lazy river they have in the dorms and some other things that people are going, oh, that's in Jacksonville. Okay.
Yeah.
We'll see how the Ospreys do beyond that. But we're looking forward to certainly the third time that the NCAA tournament is played here in Jacksonville, and I'm looking forward to being a part of it as the public address announcer. So if you guys are out there watching the games, you'll be hearing me.
Can people still get tickets to those Jacksonville games?
There are a few tickets remaining. This morning at the arena box office, probably your best bet. You can also get them online. Late last night, I was looking at the seating map of available seats, and they are few and far between. There are a few here and there, but most of the seats have been snatched up. This is a hot ticket every time that the tournament comes to Jacksonville. Of course, the teams have a an allotment of tickets. And I would tell you that usually the best way to get tickets is to wait until after the first games, and the team's fans whose teams lose are usually willing to sell those off pretty quickly. So if you're not concerned about seeing each and every game, you just want to get some action, that's usually a pretty good way to pick up those tickets on the secondary market.
Well, thank you, Cole. And that is our program today. Thank you to all of our guests and all of our callers. The show's producer is Sean Birch. The show's theme is composed and performed by Pyotr Chevchik. Have questions or comments about First Coast Connect? Send us an email at firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. And make sure to catch our daily podcasts. They're up on iTunes now. Next on the Diane Rehm Show, Israeli Prime Minister Netanyahu faces a strong challenger from the left in Tuesday's general election. Diane and her guests will discuss what the result could mean for regional tensions and the future of U.S.-Israeli relations. That's next. I'm Jessica Palumbo, and you're listening to First Coast Connect on 89.9 WJCT FM Jacksonville, your community, your world. We'll be right back here again at 9 a.m. tomorrow with Jacksonville mayoral candidate Lenny Curry. Have a great day.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.